It's Thursday, May 4th. Did Ukraine just try to bring the war to Putin's house? We start here. Russia says Ukraine sent two drones to attack the Kremlin.
We don't attack Putin or Moscow.
But Ukraine says this is Russia trying to bomb itself. A gunman opens fire at a medical center in Atlanta.
The people who work in this office came to work expecting to go home. These are people who help people save lives.
A suspect is in custody. We'll take you to the scene. And affordable housing is supposed to help people in need.
They're putting their names on these lists and just hoping to be called.
But what you don't pay in rent, you might pay in time. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. This is supposed to be a moment where Russia is launching a big offensive on Ukraine. Heavy airstrikes. That has happened. Dozens of civilians have been killed and injured in recent weeks. But something else has been happening too, stuff that's not great for Russia.
This morning, the head of Russia's Wagner mercenary forces threatens to withdraw his troops from the Battle of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine.
We've talked about the Wagner group before, these mercenary soldiers that operate kind of in tandem with the Russian army. Well, the leader of the Wagner group says it's not getting what it needs to hold the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut. This is a city some analysts had wondered if Ukraine should even try to get back. Now this Russian guy is threatening to withdraw unless Vladimir Putin gives him what he wants. That's one big issue. Another is the fact that Ukraine is not just firing on Russians who have invaded. It also appears to be attacking Russians in Russia. There have been reports of Ukrainian drones firing on Russian targets along the border, or even on the Russian side of the border. Well, yesterday, Russia claimed it had been targeted right in the heart of Moscow at the Kremlin itself. Let's start the day with Mick Mulroy, formerly of the Defense Department and the CIA. He's now an ABC News contributor. Mick, this sounded super dramatic. I mean, what happened?
So according to the Russians, Brad, they were the victims of an attempted attack on the Kremlin, which, of course, is the headquarters of the Russian government located in Moscow. And they claimed to have thwarted this, although from their claim, it looked like they didn't shoot it down until it was essentially right over the Kremlin. So it's a dubious claim, and I think we've already seen multiple U.S. officials state that they don't necessarily believe that's the case.
I would take anything coming out of the Kremlin with a very large shaker of salt. So let's see. We'll see what the facts are.
But that is what they claim.
And there's this purported video of the thing. I mean, what are we actually looking at when you watch this?
So the video shows a drone essentially going over the building of the Kremlin and then being shot down by something. There's a large plume of smoke. And then there's also some video, apparently, of what was actually shot down. Again, some would argue this is a false flag operation in the sense that it could have been Russia trying to do something that would have given them the ability to then respond. But we, you know, we'll wait and see whether that's the case.
Yeah. What would be the reason that the Russians would want to make this up? And by the way, the Ukrainians have denied doing this, right?
That's correct. So speculation, of course, I don't know this to be true, but some would say that they're looking to do something significant, maybe escalate the battle in Ukraine because of the Ukrainian counteroffensive is coming.
According to Ukrainian officials, the preparations are nearly complete. And over the weekend, President Zelensky said that this counteroffensive will happen, but he didn't say when.
And they have a lot of new weapons that NATO and the United States provided them.
Armata!
It could go very badly for the Russians. So they might know that conventionally they can't defend themselves. So they might amp it up using some kind of weapon of mass destruction. That's one theory, so to speak, on why they might have done this, to give them this excuse, if you will, to do that.
We don't attack Putin or Moscow.
Or they might go after President Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, specifically saying they're countering his attempt to assassinate.
Oh, like you guys came after Putin's residence.
Yeah.
We're going after the Ukrainian leader's residence.
Exactly. That could be the case. Of course, it also, you know, a risk, say it is a false flag operation, it does make them look very vulnerable.
Right.
I mean, according to the Russians themselves, the Ukrainians shot two drones at them that traveled 300 miles, and they didn't shoot it down till it was over the Kremlin itself.
Well, yeah, and let's talk about the concept of if Ukraine actually did this. And again, President Volodymyr Zelensky has denied that this was the Ukrainians, but if they did this, like, how would that be interpreted? Is this seen as, like, an assassination attempt on Vladimir Putin, or is this something else? I mean, what's even in the range of possibility in your mind?
So, good question. So, I don't know all of the UAVs that the Ukrainians have, obviously. I just know what's in the news. But they use mostly what's called the TB2s, which are Turkish drones. They have a range of about 180 miles max. Anywhere from Ukraine to Moscow is 300 plus miles. Hmm. So that one right there starts making, you know, analysts, I think, scratch their head going, well, how do they even conduct this? Unless you're saying that Ukrainian special forces went 112 miles into Russia and launched these, it's very unlikely that they use that drone itself. The other thing is, it's very obvious when President Putin is in the Kremlin or any place. The security goes up substantially. The Ukrainians, I am sure, track his movements. They would likely know that he was not in the Kremlin. So it doesn't make sense that it was an assassination attempt on him, since most everybody would know he isn't even there.
We fight on our territory. We are defending our villages and cities.
And of course, the Ukrainians would also, I think, irritate their biggest backer, the United States, because they've already said, they've already came out, they being like Secretary Blinken, the Secretary of State, and said they didn't know anything about it.
Well, first, I've seen the reports. I can't in any way validate them. We simply don't know.
So if Ukrainians are trying to assassinate President Putin, which could significantly escalate the conflict, and they didn't even tell their number one backer, that would be a lot of blowback. So I don't think they would risk that as well. This is all speculation. I do believe the intelligence community will find out what happened. They can go back. We collect a lot of information that we can go back and look at, whether it's imagery or signals or any of that. So I do think that we will be able to determine whether we'll say it or not, I don't know. But I do think the intelligence community, the CIA especially, will go back and try to determine exactly what happened.
Well, and like you said, like, seems like a weird story to tell, though, if you're Russia and you're trying to project strength, and to say, actually, these guys are so good that they got a drone hovering right over the Kremlin. We only managed to get it in the nick of time. So, like, even the storylines that the Russians are putting out there, whether it's true or not, that storyline is no one in Russia is necessarily fully safe from the Ukrainians at this point. All right, Mick Mulroy, formerly of the CIA and DOD. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the shooting happened in the same waiting room where our reporter has sat many times. We go there after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
A doctor's office is supposed to make you feel inherently safe, but that feeling was shattered yesterday in Atlanta, Georgia, when a man walked into a medical facility with a gun and opened fire. Let's go to ABC Steve Osunsami, who's on the scene right now. And Steve, can you just tell me, like, where was this?
So this was in Midtown Atlanta, a very busy part of town. It was during the lunch hour when this happened.
We were on a lunch break, and I was taking a work call. And I was walking around the front of the building where the lobby is, and I noticed a lot of commotion.
And this doctor's office was on one of the top floors of a medical building. And Brad, I got to tell you, for full disclosure, this happened to be my doctor's office. My doctor's there.
Wow.
Yes. my doctor's office, my husband's doctor's office. I've spent plenty of time in this office. I'm intimately familiar with it. And so when I was reaching out to people from the office to find out what happened, I knew exactly where the areas they were talking about. They were telling me that the shooting took place in a couple different spots. One was in front of the reception desk in the waiting room, and then the chaos, I'm told, spilled into the hallway that leads you to the elevators that take you downstairs. I don't know if you saw that picture of the suspect that police were sending around yesterday. That picture was taken from one of those elevators. And we were hearing reports of blood on the floor of the elevator as it went all the way down to the bottom level and opened up. But yeah, it was a doctor's office. It's a fairly large practice, a number of doctors in that office. And it just was shocking.
I heard some policemen outside saying, you know, come out with your hands up or hold your hands up. And I was like, that doesn't sound good. So then I kind of went to the back of the room where I was and stayed there for about a good 20, 30 minutes.
These shootings happen so often now and touch so many Americans that it was kind of shocking to me when I realized, because I was texting people who I knew in the office asking about what's going on in your building, and then only to learn it was in their office.
So one woman was killed there. You got three other patients in critical condition. You actually spoke to the mother of the suspect, Steve. Did she say what could have happened?
We had a quick phone call with her where she says that her son was there asking for a certain medication and was unable to get that medication and blamed the shooting on that frustration. And that's what she told us that we're able to share. But of course, you know, we don't know why the practice may not have had very good reason not to give him that medication. You know, the one thing that was also, you know, kind of frightening about what happened here is that after the shooting, there was an attempted carjacking in the parking lot of the building that was unsuccessful. And then police say that he walked about a block or so away to a gas station where he was able to carjack a vehicle. And it's in that vehicle that he made his escape out of Midtown, downtown Atlanta.
An undercover officer was the one that originally saw and confronted this individual and was able to then have backup from uniform officers that came in and took him into custody without incident.
Well, we know that he used to be a member of the Coast Guard until January, so he only recently left the service. You know, I just got to go back to the people who work in this office. Came to work, expecting to go home. These are people who help people save lives. And, you know, now this. And so just a frightening day for a lot of people. And this part of town also was on lockdown for a bit. You know, the major streets blocked off, traffic at a standstill. People worried that, you know, they had a gunman who might be hiding in their building or behind their cars. You know, it was a frightening moment for people who in this part of town.
Yeah, and so many family members of victims talk about this kind of growing fraternity that you're talking about, Steve, where around the country, the more and more you look around, the more everyone's life has been affected in one way or another by gun violence. Experiencing it there on the ground in Atlanta, Steve Osunsami, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We live in a country where two things are true. In recent years, the housing market has exploded, right? Home prices are higher than ever. More homes are being built because of it. And yet we also see more and more people without affordable housing.
In just the city of Los Angeles alone, last year's count revealed 47,000 people living on the street.
We need to focus with more energy and precision on addressing encampments. There's no humanity in that.
Homelessness is on the rise. And with both of those things being true, you might expect the government to be offering more public housing, right? More options. Well, for the last several months, our investigative unit at ABC News, in collaboration with ABC-owned television stations around the country, have been looking at the wait lists for housing options and how jaw-droppingly long those waits have become. ABC's Stephanie Ramos has been looking at this. And Stephanie, I mean, how long of a wait are we talking about?
Brad, it is wild. I mean, there are families that have been waiting a decade, 12 years, 13 years. Mm. There are families that have just spent so many years on subsidized housing wait lists, and the patience and resilience that these families exhibit is just incredible. Imagine losing your job. You've got to take care of your family. You're getting kicked out of your current place. Mm. You have no help. It's dire for so many families across the country.
It sucks seeing how many buildings that are brand new being built and me not being able to get not one.
We caught up with a single mother, Brunel Whitfield, in San Diego. She joined the San Diego subsidized housing wait list. She was a single mother with two young children. 12 years later, Brad, 12 years later, she's now a mother of four, and she is desperate to find places for her family to live.
I've done miracles to keep us off of the streets. I experienced homelessness a couple times, you know, unfortunately.
Day by day, her kids are 18, 14, 8, and 7 years old, and they are still waiting for housing. Wow. This is how bad the situation is. That's in San Diego. But over this last decade, Brunel and her family, they've been homeless on and off, trying to find a place to stay. At times, they've slept in a car, a tent, just miles away from some of California's wealthiest neighborhoods. And it's so striking because we see that in so many different cities, that, you know, on one block, they'll have, you know, the best looking homes. And then just a few miles down the road, you've got so many families that are struggling and have no place to go.
And you said there are like multiple ways to get subsidized housing here, right? You got the public housing that's like there's a housing project not too far from my house. Like that's built and owned by the local government. But then there's also, you mentioned Section 8. That's like vouchers where the government just gives you money to go rent a house, right?
You're exactly right. Housing vouchers, which are local subsidies, helping renters find homes on the private market. Now, the average wait varies across the country in various cities. But in San Diego County, for instance, it's 8 years. ABC's data analysis shows that public housing wait times exceed 17 years in Suffolk County, New York, 9 years in Meeker County, Minnesota, and 6 years in Hinds County, Mississippi. So a lot of these families are just, they're putting their names on these lists and just hoping to be called, whether it's in, you know, a few years or for some families, 10 to 12 years.
Frustrated, sad, sometimes hopeless that I'm never going to come up on that list.
Now, we met up with somebody else on the other side of San Diego County who also joined the housing list around the same time that Brunel Whitfield did. And she also had a very difficult time trying to find a home. Her name is Tanya Frazier. She joined two housing wait lists the same year, and she's still waiting.
This is the waiting list portal, August 9th, 2011.
And it's been more than a decade.
And Stephanie, like the obvious question then is, why isn't there more public housing? Like you're telling me about, we're hearing about booms in construction in places like San Diego, and yet, what is none of that public housing?
That's exactly right, Brad. Public housing, large scale public housing, just isn't being built.
There isn't a state in the country where someone working at minimum wage with 40 hours a week can afford a typical, you know, two-bedroom apartment.
We actually spoke with an NYU professor who studies this, Dr. Jacob Faber, and he brought up the Richard Nixon moratorium. He said Richard Nixon put a moratorium on that construction back in the 1970s. And for some reason, it's stuck around. But the demand, and we know this, the demand for affordable housing has only increased, just like housing prices have as well. So that's where we are. It's just there's so much of a need, but the public housing just isn't there and it's not being built.
Well, and the frustrating thing, Stephanie, is I feel like public housing has gotten such a bad rap in this country for like a lot of good reasons, right? But a lot of people looked at these housing projects and said, like, we can't do this. This is not working. This is a failed experiment. But then we never came up with like another idea beyond the public housing, right? Like clearly there's not enough Section 8 money. Otherwise, everyone who needed it would get these vouchers. They don't. If you don't have more public housing being built in a place like San Diego, which wasn't nearly as big 50 years ago, there's just not going to be enough public housing for people that need it. So are there any solutions here?
Well, there are cities across the country that are trying to come up with solutions. In Philadelphia, for instance, they have come up with a pilot program. It's the PHL Housing Plus program, but it's a pilot program. So it's only going to be around for about another 2 years. They've given it 2.5 years, and it's been working for the last 5 to 6 months. Now, what's really unique about this program is that they randomly select applicants who are on the PHA waitlist, the Philadelphia Housing Authority waitlist, and they give them a monthly stipend calculated to bridge the gap between their income and housing expenses.
Oh, like you're on the bottom of the wait list, but we'll tide you over with some cash.
Exactly.
It gets stressing. It gets depressing. Sometimes I just go back to Atlanta? You know, sometimes it be days like that, but It's rough.
We spoke with a woman, Dawn Adams, who is a part of this program, and she's been on the Philadelphia Housing Authority list for the last several years. And she was in a really bad situation. She was living with a friend here and there. She lost her daughter to gun violence several years ago. So she came back to Philadelphia from Atlanta to try and get custody of her grandson. She wasn't able to do that because she didn't have a home. She didn't have a place to stay. Now, then all of a sudden, after a couple of years, she gets a call from PHL Housing Plus, and they tell her, you've been selected because you're on this wait list. We're going to give you some money to help you out until it works out for you. It helps her day by day. Will it help her in the long run? We don't know. But this is how they're moving forward.
That's frustrating sometimes. But I figure since I came this far and I got picked from that, I figure it won't be long before I find somewhere to go.
Philadelphia, the folks behind this program are hoping that other cities catch on to this and do something like this to help the folks that are on these housing authority lists for years and years and years with no sort of help.
I don't think we're doing enough. And I think that there is the will, but we need to find the way in order to build bipartisan support to get it done.
The other thing that could help the situation is more federal funding, but that's not even there. Now, we reached out to HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, several times, but they wouldn't even give us an interview. But the agency did give us a statement, and HUD says that they recognize that the country faces an affordable housing shortage, and that in this year's budget proposal, the administration has requested additional resources to address this issue.
Yeah, and it's so scary because you think of, like, public housing seems like the bottom of the barrel for so many people. Like, I guess I would pull that trigger if I really had to, if I was really in a desperate situation. Well, people are in desperate situations, and guess what? They still cannot get access to this thing for years at a time. Stephanie Ramos, along with our investigative unit, really great reporting. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, if it wasn't for Hamilton and Nicolas Cage movies, I don't know how many of these I would have gotten right. It's time for a quiz bowl. One last thing is next. And one last thing. Quick, are you smarter than an eighth grader?
Feeling smart?
No.
Yesterday, the U.S. got its test results back on 8th grade history in the form of a report card from the National Assessment for Educational Progress. And these grades aren't pretty.
This is what I would do in school. I would circle it, and erase it, and that would be the wrong answer.
We've heard about declines in reading and math scores, but we now know that history scores are plummeting too. Our team actually puzzled through the actual U.S. history questions students are facing.
Here we go. What helped farmers in the early Massachusetts Bay Colony be successful?
According to the result, only half of students could tell you where Black Americans went in the country during the Great Migration. Only 13% of students were considered proficient.
The correct answer is B. Farming techniques learned from local Native Americans. Very
Yay,
good, Jen.
Jen! I'd like to thank my fans.
But there are bigger concerns here than historical details. Researchers say they've specifically seen a drop-off in how much students comprehend about democracy. And this downward trend, it predates the pandemic. Some say it's because there are no federal rules stipulating standardized tests for social science the way the government demands math and reading scores. Say what you want about standardized tests, but schools do often gear their priorities around them, and this report card says now only half of eighth graders have a teacher on campus whose job is primarily about teaching U.S. history. Now, there is a chance to turn the scores around. Polling shows young people are getting more politically engaged. But when students who weren't getting these answers right were asked straight up, Do you feel confident telling whether a source is trustworthy? The vast majority in this report said no. The fewer facts they knew, the more trouble they had separating fact from fiction. Meaning, our country might have even bigger tests still to come. It's so sad when you go through these questions, because you get one wrong and you're like, well, that's okay. Like, I'm not in school anymore. I would have known this back then. And then you get one right and you're like, in your face, eighth graders. Like, your generation's terrible. Like, I'm glad my extra years of education made me able to do all that. Shows how evolved I am. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brian Mielke. I'm off for the next couple days, but you will be in good hands with ABC's Mark Remillard. I'll see you next week.
All right. How do you guys feel?
Mixed.
Dumb.
I'm proud of you every day, though.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.